if I ever make it to like my 60s or 70s, I hope to be one of those like older choir ladies that yes. like still goes to choir once a week. You know, it's just like all that, and still, you know, makes music with people. Yeah. And that does continue to affect what I do. I remember a composer, we had sung her music and I was like, wow, I love her music. Mm. And I reached out to her and I was like, we just sang this piece of yours and I think it's so beautiful. And I was like, if you ever are thinking of doing a piece with design, like, reach out. Yeah. And she said, actually, I'm writing a Requiem for Water. You know, and now we've done like multiple collaborations together.
Today, we have Camilla Tassi.
She's a projection designer that has worked on Broadway, at Carnegie Hall, the LA Opera, Miami City Ballet, Walt Disney Concert Hall, and like the list of venues just goes on and on and on. So I'm so excited to speak with you today, and welcome to Failing Up with Sharon.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I actually would really love to trace this all back to kind of your childhood. Like, what were your early years like? Because you grew up in Florence, Italy, right?
Yeah. I grew up in Florence. And, you know, we didn't move to America until 2005. And that was my parents and my brother and I, we moved together. And, you know, growing up in, I know, you know, it feels a little bit cliche, but, you know, growing up in Florence, you're surrounded by... Yeah. visual art and architecture all the time. You know, I mean, I've been playing piano since I was in elementary school, but I was a big math kid growing up, and that was my favorite subject. And I guess in the background, I knew that I wanted to go into some sort of math field. But, and you know, and then when we moved to America, we moved to Central Florida of all places. Big culture shock. Everything was very different and very new also. But, you know, not, when I think back to it, both math and music were things that were the same regardless of language. So that's, you know, potentially a way I sort of, you know, continue to find a sense of home there. Also, I loved technology since I was a kid. You know, I played a bunch of video games growing up. And, you know, I made my mom, she gave me her Game Boy when I was 4. And so, you know. But in a way, all of this links together to, you know, eventually through a number of things led me to projection design, which for me is a mixture of both, you know, the technology and the art, sort of art side.
I think that so often people think that if you have a creative love or I am horrible at math, but you know, my dad's very good at math and he's always just like programming is an art, right? But I think that it's so easy to look at the two of those as two completely separate entities, and it feels like Sophie's Choice for most people, right? They're like, I either have to become a mathematician or an accountant or something like that, or I need to go into conservatory. And do you think that would have been possible if you didn't immigrate to America with your family?
No, that's such a good point that you bring up. In the Italian sort of university system, you have to pick.
Yeah.
You have to choose between going to conservatory when you go to undergrad or going into, there's no such thing as being able to do a dual major or a dual degree. So I'm super thankful because I ended up studying computer science and music as dual degrees in undergrad. You know, that wouldn't have been possible. And that defined sort of, it was the chance to be able to sort of do both simultaneously. That then it's, you know, I had gotten a full-time job offer in corporate, but because I thought I was going to go into computer science, I was just going to, you know, do this degree in music to get the most out of it and to be able, you know, I wanted to take music theory and I wanted to challenge myself as much as I could. But I had a really influential mentor who taught the graduate conducting students at my undergrad. And she was kind of the reason I decided, oh, wait, I'm not done with the arts. And she sort of was one of the few people that encouraged both of my sides, because I found very often that a lot of professors only understood a half of me.
Sure.
They wouldn't understand my tech side or understand my music side. And where my voice teacher would just say, you should be practicing more. You shouldn't be producing this.
Right.
And, wow. You know?
You know, I think that that's something so incredible to think about, is like the role that our teachers play in our lives, and mm-hmm. how, you know, mm-hmm. at the time, it's just someone that's looking out for us, and they see us. Honestly, I feel like our teachers see us at our lowest points, right? Because totally. They see us trying to understand or figure something out. They see us either not connecting to something, or they see something that we can't even see yet within who we are, right?
That's true.
And I'm just so curious how something like that was presented to you, because what year were you in school, in undergrad?
Yeah, I was in undergrad from 2011 to 2016.
Yeah. So like projection design in particular was so early in its
more mainstream iteration. You know, it's so interesting because projection design has existed for a long time. And if we look even at, you know, early 20th century, you know, in Germany with Piscator and all of them. But and even, you know, we don't think about it, but it definitely was not as widespread as it is now in performance. So eventually I did an MA in a program that was very, it was called an MA in Digital Music, but it was a program that really felt like a sandbox. And I want to stress like the importance of like the existence of that degree that was kind of multidisciplinary, is like that degree became my launch point and became sort of a home when I didn't even know what to apply to after. You know, moving undergrad and turning down like a corporate job offer. And now I was like, Mom and Dad, I want to do grad school in the arts. And they're like, okay, but you need to be able to support yourself.
Sure.
There was this incredible, fully funded with stipend to your MA program at Dartmouth. And that was called Digital Music. Now it's called Sonic Arts. And now they turned it into an MFA, which is kind of amazing. That program is what introduced me to theater. That program is what introduced me to lighting design and scenic design and things that I had never taken, and things that suddenly I thought, oh, this makes so much sense. I want classical music to be asking these questions. I want concert music to be asking these questions. Questions that theater asked all the time, but that concert music wasn't. And so anyways, back to through projection design, after that incredible program, and after I started sort of professionally designing for ensembles while I was in school, I asked my lighting professor, I said, is there such a thing as a degree in projection? I want to really, like, I love this. I want to dive into this more. And he said, check out Yale. And at the time, Wendell Harrington, who's now in her 70s, she was the only woman that was head of a projection program. Granted, yes, there are only a handful of graduate projection programs, but sure. I thought how amazing. And she had been doing this since like she was one of the first people to ever do it on Broadway, for example.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, in the 90s, they were doing, you know, the Who's Tommy with glass slide projectors. And they had, you know, like a bunch of little glass slide projectors on the balcony.
Yeah, that's right.
Back when none of it was digital, you know, or not digital in the sense that we think of it now.
Yeah.
And so, but it's true that it didn't really, you know, it kind of feels that only recently it's really exploded in a way.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think, you know, I always tell people I have a love-hate relationship with projection design, because it can be really not in support of the performers, and a bit like too spectacle and too much. And sometimes
it's like an excuse to not have set design sometimes.
Yes.
Like it's,
or an excuse to have bad set design.
Can I, just in case people don't actually know, what is projection design?
So projection design is the incorporation of both still and video imagery onto a physical set. And that can be through the use of actual projectors that are mapping and projecting onto architecture, onto a set, or the use of LED walls, TVs. It can be like screens also count as video/projection design is how they call it. For example, I'm about to design a show where might surface is our, the set incorporates 10 different TVs.
Ooh.
And those become like what the content is on in a way. And, wow. You know, it also means, you know, the incorporation sometimes of like camera work and live feed onto projection or video design. But yeah, and there's sort of so many parts of it because obviously there's the hardware side of it and like the system design. And then there's the, you know, the visual content of it all. And that's, and that can have so many variations. And, you know, it, on larger shows, it's a whole like team. You may have a projection designer and an associate and an assistant and a programmer and an engineer and sometimes an illustrator. It can be as big as that. And then other projects, it's just you and you have to kind of do all the roles.
Yeah. Well, through discovering and working through projection design and getting hired for different gigs, I'm so curious about the jobs that you've loved, the jobs that made you want to tear your hair out, and how did all of that kind of like, your fabulous hair, by the way, always amazing.
Likewise.
Oh, thank you. It's the redhead corner over here. But like, how did those moments of success and then moments of like, oh my God, how, like, why am I doing this with you? Because collaboration. Totally. How did that lead you to figuring out the kind of artist that you are?
Yeah. So the thing that's a little bit interesting about people who go into projection design is that compared to fields like costume design or scenic design, people may be coming from outlets that are not just theater.
Yes.
For example, you know, you'll meet projection designers that come from film. What was interesting for me is that I came from music and computer science. So one thing that, you know, people may not be aware of, because all these graduate theater design programs are in theater departments, you are taught, and in classes and assignments and everything, you're taught to design for a script. It could be a musical, but it's you know, it's still, you're being taught to design for a script. And so what happens when there's no words? What happens when there's, you know, when there's a score? So something I learned that became a strength in just finding avenues of work is I'm a musician. I read scores. I interpret scores. And I'm sensitive to performers of this music.
Yeah.
And so when I design concert work, it's different from when I design, you know, plays or musicals or opera, because, for example, there may not be a stage director because there's no quote unquote staging. But at that point, you're the one leading the visual, the visual language. You know, yes, I will have, for example, if it's a premiere of a new work or even a current composer's work, I will always have conversations with the composer to show them kind of like where, you know, what I'm thinking, where I'm at, make sure I'm honoring the intent of their work and that, you know, we're on the same page. I like to have at least one conversation with a composer. And then, and, you know, other times you're in conversation with the conductor or the performers themselves. And so you show storyboards to them. I think it's always about being sensitive because it is always about thinking, how are you actually serving the story? How are you helping the story? Like, what's your role there? I find that the most satisfying projects where projection is integrated is because it has a really clear dramatic purpose.
Yeah.
And I will say the least satisfying projects are when, I joke, I call them like scenic plus, is when you're sort of like set embellishment, which is fine. And it can be done in nice ways. But you really have to have a great scenic surface or a great, you know, sort of, or maybe you're supporting transitions or maybe, you know, and that's fine too. But the most satisfying ones are where projection has its own really clear dramaturgical reason for being there. Like, for example, is projection the dreams of this character and like the subconscious of this character? Is projection the, you know, is projection a character of its own that is, you know, in conversation with the character. And so those make it so much more exciting.
It has to be an entire world that exists together.
Exactly. I guess ultimately it's like you're there in a position of support. You're not the main event. Yeah. You're there in a position of support. But it also feels like magic, right? Because when you see, you know, projection coming into a space or interacting with bodies, or
it's otherworldly.
Really cool. Yes.
Well, not to be a Debbie Downer, but no, how do you handle then if, you know, because all of projection design is happening in real life and it's technology, right? It's exactly what it is. And in the way that an actor or performer can forget their line or a musician can miss an entrance. Like, what happens though if it doesn't work? Like, I remember I saw what show was it? There was a show I was watching. Oh, I feel like I actually just shouldn't say it out loud, but it doesn't matter. When I went to see...
It happens to every show, so don't worry.
That's true. My best friend, who actually was in an earlier episode of Failing Up with me, Jason Gauthier, was in this incredible production at Lincoln Center of Floyd Collins. It was beautiful. And honestly, I thought their use of projection design was really beautiful. And it was so simple that it actually took a while to realize it was projection design. It just it kind of built the atmosphere of the show, which was
very cool.
But then they used one of those huge digital screens in the back, like the whole wall. Probably. Yeah. And then there was a large, like 4 by 5 foot square panel that just stopped working. And then there was this huge black square in the middle.
It totally was an LED wall. It totally was an LED wall then.
What
just
is that?
I've lived it. Lived it too. I remember we were about to do a dress rehearsal for Fiddler. And part of the wall started having, a big, like, black square section, which means a couple of the tiles are not getting signal. Because LED walls are built out of, they're all tiles.
Right.
And so we thought, oh no, we can't have that with a dress rehearsal. They're also going to take photos. So let's, you have a configuration file and you can sort of refresh it to see if it nudges them and then it gets signal back.
Mm.
Except we did that and the whole wall went dark.
Oh no.
And we didn't have an engineer there, which we should have had. They had to do the whole dress rehearsal with the wall just being black. Similar to Floyd Collins, it was like the main scenic surface.
Right.
The main scenic backdrop. And so it was a very awkward dress.
Yeah.
Stuff like that happens.
Yeah.
And the thing is, that's part of the beauty of live performance and the reality of, like, the thing is, it happens at all scales. I was just at the Met Opera seeing an opera that had projections and they glitched twice in the show.
Yeah.
But, it's just part of, sometimes it is about budget and sometimes it's about resources. As I mentioned, for example, the Fiddler that I was on, we didn't have an engineer on site for the whole period. And so, when stuff like that happens, I think about the fact that, it's live performance.
Yeah.
Things happen.
Yeah.
Of course, one should really design a system so that it's able to handle different things and not have these issues.
Yeah.
But it could happen.
When you see that, all the work that you've built and it's at the helm of technology and wires and like Wi-Fi.
Right.
But like, how do you, I don't know, how does it make you feel when you see it? I know it's so out of your control. Like
distracting, right? It's super distracting. So now you're doing the opposite of, like, instead of being really seamlessly integrated, you're like calling attention to a technical failure. But I will say one great thing about plays and musicals is that they usually will have a longer, like, multiple runs, right? So they may run for a whole month. So even if something does happen in one performance, hopefully it doesn't, but even if it does happen in one performance, it's not the only performance of it that's gonna happen, right?
That's true.
What I find more nerve-wracking is when I design concerts, often it's just the one and done concert.
Yeah.
A lot of classical music works like that, where they'll do a big premiere. I'm about to design a Mozart Requiem at Lincoln Center and it's one night only event. And so the stakes are really high because there, you only get the one chance. Oh my God. Or like, yes, when I design at Carnegie Hall, you only get the one chance there. I guess I'm grateful that out of all of my past ones, I only had one that I was, that I had a bit of a technical issue, that it was a one night event. And even then, it wasn't that it like went dark or anything. It was like just like subtly flickering a little bit
in
like the blue colors, because it was bad cable. But I remember at the time being so frustrated, and it was taking me out of it, because when I do those one time concerts to help minimize even just like wrong cue calling, because that can also totally happen. You know, a stage manager calls a cue early, or the board operator presses when they weren't supposed to. That stuff happens too. Of course. It's part of like, you know, humans. So you make human error. But I remember running the show and being so upset by the visual thing that it was taking me out of it. But yes, that's to add to like help lessen at least, or up like mitigate with these like big one-off concerts. I end up running them, which typically designers don't run shows. When you have a one-time show with hundreds of cues, I think it's too much to ask of another person that didn't design and doesn't know the piece like cue to just, you know, what, just do one dress rehearsal and then do the thing. It's because I will tell people, I hate watching a show if I'm not near a computer where I could do something goes wrong. Just designed a play. It was a new play in the Boston area. And so plays go through what are called previews, where they have an audience, but the show's not frozen yet. And so during previews, and I sat in the way back with, we had my laptop networked to the booth computer just in case something would go, if something were to go wrong, I could jump in. And I was screen sharing it to the booth computer, because there's nothing worse than seeing something technical go wrong and you're just in a seat with all the other audience members and there's nothing you can do. So that is my least favorite. That's why I love, like, at a certain point as a designer, you may be there until opening or what. And then when it opens, you go home.
That's it.
And then you don't have to, you know, like sit through it. It's just like there is the something anxiety. About, you know, I want things to go well. I'm very like organized and a little bit of a control freak. So it is really hard to just let go and then say, well, now it's not in my hands anymore. And I have to push myself other times to say, no, Camilla, don't look at the patch anymore. Because now if something goes wrong, they need to know how to do it without you. Because they're going to be doing that for a month without you.
So a lot of trust. It's a
big thing in letting go. and letting go and having trust. And you know, one thing it made me have is a lot more grace towards other artists. Because maybe, you know, when I was younger, I would go to a show and think, oh, I can't believe, like, you know, the projector blend is off, or I can't believe like that's bad. And now I look back, I'm like, well, it totally makes sense.
Yeah, you this know, building was built in 1805. Yeah. Like, I don't know what to tell you over here. So it's, I love hearing you talk about all of this, but I'm curious, like, are there things that you're still figuring out? Is there ever a time you still feel like a beginner of sorts? Like,
100%.
What are those things?
Totally. Well, I'm a believer in you should try to know the basics of as many aspects as possible. But it's tough to be an expert in everything. And that's, you know, for example, I had to, and I still, there's much that I'm, so much that I'm still learning. I'm not an expert in like system design. I'm not a, so I asked the people that know more than me. You know, I asked my partner, I asked other people, because I'm constantly learning. I'm like, oh, I actually don't know how to do this part. Or on the content creation side, you know, I'm not strong in 3D content creation. And, you know, and it's a balance, because you could say, okay, when I do have a bit more time, do I want to spend like diving into the skill set and learning more how to do this thing? Or, you know, it's sort of like we all have finite amount of time. And so what do we focus on, right?
Yeah.
Is it learning this new this new technique of doing a 2D animation? Is it learning how to do more technique of this 3D animation? What media server you're going to program in and stuff. And, you know, I don't know how to program at all in disguise, which is a big media server that's used a lot on larger shows and things. Sure. But that's where I've also learned that it's okay. Mm. You should always be pushing yourself to learn more.
Yeah.
But it's also okay because this is meant to be a collaborative field. So, you know, I will, you know, with the funds of the production, hire or with out of my own feet, hire, you know, a 3D content animator if that's something that the production really needs in its language.
Yeah.
Someone that specializes in that. Or, you know, if the production has to be done in D3, you hire a programmer that is an expert in that. So how do you give the best output that you can, given the resources, given the budget, given the support positions? And I try to advocate for more support positions as time goes on. I know it's a hard time though in the arts, so it's like you win some, you lose some on that front.
Oh gosh, this has just been, it's so amazing to listen to and talk to you. Listen, I'm looking at your face.
Oh, thank you.
And so I, you know, my last question for you is something that I ask every single person that comes on this podcast, is what does success mean to you?
I think for me, success feels like being able to have some balance in nurturing, you know, personal life and relationships and family and my art. I think that's too important. You know, for me, my friendship, my partner, my family are things that keep me grounded, you know, and even like a sense of home, I think is really important, especially when traveling a lot. So that to me looks like success. I want to continue to push myself. Like, I love going into projects. I'm about to go into one next month where I think, okay, I've never done this kind of thing. And I'm not super sure how to do it, but I'm, you know, I'm excited to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes people ask me, it's like, oh, what, you know, what's next or what's your dream? And I'm like, I feel like I am living what I want to be doing. Mm. And if anything, it's about, I want to continue to be in rooms where I'm challenged. I want to continue being, you know, ideally in rooms where I'm respected as a human and as an artist, and I'm treated with respect, because, you know, sometimes some, you know, some spaces are not always that. And so you can go through an experience and know, okay, I want to work with these people again, or maybe I don't want to work with these people again. So I definitely want to be in rooms where I'm, you know, valued as a member of this team, and where I'm challenged, and where, you know, I'm finding joy artistically and technically in a thing. So I want to continue to be pushed. I think it gets tougher if you feel like, oh, this is sort of too simple of a project, or, you know, a lot of absolutely friends say, oh, how are you, you know, how are you not burnt out or something? And that's because for now, the work is giving back to me a lot. Now, does every project do that all the time? No,
that's not possible.
There are some that are difficult and you're like, I'm so excited to be done with this project. Yeah. But with others, you're like, wow, this is feeding me back in a way that I don't mind giving more to it because it's feeding me back.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Camilla, this was so amazing.
Thank you. It was so fun to talk to you.
Yes.
And thank you for having me. Oh,
yeah, you're a star. And I want everyone to look up everything they can about you, because your work is really so magical.
The Artist Business Plan Podcast is presented by The Super Fair, the widest ranging art fair in the United States. For more information on applying to The Super Fair, visit our website at thesuperfair.com. There you'll also find our full back catalog of episodes, as well as other resources to help you build your business plan. If you like what you heard, send us a message on Instagram. You can follow us at The Super Fair. Thanks for listening.